Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
We've been focusing on Domestic Violence Awareness Month, which is April, but April's a very heavy month. It also is Child Abuse Awareness Month, and I do believe the two go hand in hand. Maybe you don't have the same things going on in one household, but sometimes they do intersect a little bit. But I wanted to focus a little bit more on child abuse and breaking the cycle and better protecting our families. According to childhelp.org, every year more than 4 million referrals are made to child protection agencies involving more than 4.3 million children who are impacted. The United States has one of the worst records among the nations, losing on average 5 children every day to child abuse and neglect. So this morning, we're going to talk about this. Again, it's a very heavy topic, but it's something we really need to dive into. So we are chatting this morning with Kate Twikla-Masses. It's Katie. Excuse me, Katie. Katie, first of all, I don't want to botch your name. How do you say your last name correctly?
Twikla-Masses.
Twikla-Masses. Okay. Well, Katie, we welcome you. You are the Director of Youth and Adult Services at the Center for Family Justice. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So what clinical services are available right now? What do you guys offer for kids here in Connecticut?
We are an accredited child advocacy center through the National Children's Alliance that serves Bridgeport, Stratford, Trumbull, Easton, Monroe, and Fairfield. And as a CAC, we provide forensic interviews, advocacy, and mental health therapy for kids that have disclosed severe abuse. And all those services are offered on site.
Wow. So what are some of the more common calls that you get? What do those situations look like?
The majority of the cases that come to the CAC are sexual abuse, but we also have physical abuse cases, witness to violence, and trafficking cases as well.
It's interesting you say trafficking. So what age, like what would you say is the common age range that you're getting these calls?
So we see kids between the ages of 3 and 17. The majority of our cases are teenagers, but that's because it is easier for teens to disclose. Sometimes younger kids don't have the ability, either language-wise or developmental-wise, to be able to disclose what's going on at home.
Mm-hmm. And are these teens who are reporting it, or are they teachers? Is it DCF? Like, where do most of your calls come from?
So our referrals come from DCF as well as law enforcement, and a lot of kids do disclose at school or to their therapists or to friends.
And the reason I brought up trafficking really quickly, Katie, was because it wasn't that long ago that we had the FBI on our show, maybe a couple months ago, and they were talking about how actually Fairfield County, if you were to look at the whole state of Connecticut, that's where some of the most trafficking is going on for young women, especially that it's these younger high school students who get caught up in either the wrong places, the wrong people, and sometimes it's a matter of the fact that they have money and that's what attracts people to them. I don't know, but that's when you said trafficking, it made me think of that, and I wasn't sure what you're seeing, if it is in fact, you know, more of the teens, or if it is, like you were saying, that they're the ones who can actually speak on behalf of themselves. But when you've got a 6-year-old, that, you know, they probably have no idea what's going on or couldn't even really articulate what's happening to them.
Yeah, I would say the majority of our trafficking cases are between the ages of 12 to 17 that come in.
And when you say trafficking, are you talking about, you know, young people being used, being exploited physically? Are you like, what do you mean by trafficking?
So we predominantly see sex trafficking cases. So people who are either paying money or giving goods in exchange for sex with minors.
Got it. We're talking this morning to Katie Twikla-Masses, and Katie is the Director of Youth and Adult Services at the Center for Family Justice. How challenging was it for you to do your job during the pandemic when, especially in the beginning, everyone was isolated? Kids couldn't even go to school. So if they were having an issue, there was no opportunity for them to go to people like their teachers, like you were saying. How challenging was that?
At first, in March 2020, it was very challenging because we did go remote. We were able to pivot pretty quickly, but we didn't have the PPE to keep going in person because some of our services do have to be in person. But we were able to regroup within about a month to get everything back on track. And then, you know, as in that summer when things started to open up a little bit more, our referrals started to increase again.
I'm curious, Katie, how long have you been working in this sector?
I've been at the center 15 years. I've been doing child abuse for about 7 years.
So does it shock you that the United States is considered one of the worst records among the nations for child abuse cases and child losses?
It is. It's sad because we do have so many resources available to us. You know, we should be doing a lot better job.
I mean, do you believe that even here in Connecticut that we should be doing more?
We can always do more. You know, the theme for this year's Child Abuse Prevention Month is giving a better tomorrow for all children together. And really the message is that we all play a role in helping to keep kids safe and healthy and helping them to grow up to have positive outcomes.
We have the incredible pleasure of chatting this morning with Katie Quiklamasses. And Katie does work at the Center for Family Justice and has for many years as the Director of Youth and Adult Services. And this morning we're talking about better protecting children from abuse, from neglect, from trafficking. It's a hard subject to talk about. And Katie, I give you unbelievable amounts of credit for what you do every day. I have no idea how you can do it. Let's talk about just some of the health impacts, the long term for kids who survive this kind of abuse or going through what they do, and then they come out the other end. What sort of is the long-term effect for these kids if it's not caught early enough and they go through this kind of trauma?
If trauma goes unaddressed, it can affect somebody for their entire life, including negative health consequences later on, heart disease, diabetes, as well as unhealthy coping mechanisms like drinking, using drugs, things like that. But there are a lot of evidence-based mental health modalities that can be utilized in order to intervene at an early age that works with both the child and the parent. And the studies show that the symptoms of PTSD and other mental health disorders caused by the trauma can be decreased through these modalities.
And I think this is the fact that really got me, and this is what scares me, which I don't know if you could kind of lean into a little bit. So according to national studies in 2019, so before the pandemic, state agencies identified an estimated 1,800 children who died as a result of abuse and neglect. So that's about 5 kids a day, which is what we talked about. However, studies indicated significant undercounting of child maltreatment fatalities. So to put that into perspective, that's like looking at an elementary school classroom and seeing 25% of them disappear by the end of the year, which is just, it's hard to fathom. But the idea that there's a lot of underreporting, essentially, we can't just know that this is what's going on. Can you speak to that? The idea that there are probably a lot of children we just don't know are going through this.
Yeah, child abuse, just like domestic violence and adult sexual violence, is underreported. We can all do things as a community to try to recognize the signs, to put supports in place for parents and caregivers. Even businesses can promote cultures of parent support so that stressors are relieved. Youth serving organizations can do things to train up their staff to recognize the signs of abuse. And like I said before, we can all be supports to kids in our lives so that if something is going on, they feel that they have a mentor and a support in their life that they can go to.
Why do you think it happens? I know it sounds like a very open-ended question, but why do you think a parent can look at their child and do what's being done?
There's a lot of contributing factors. Some of it is, if somebody grew up in a household where there was violence, but also there's community factors like community violence, poverty, social isolation. Everything contributes to the situation.
Do you think that societal pressures for people to become parents has anything to do with, not all, obviously, but some abuse for kids?
Sure. And, with COVID-19 going on and more social isolation and less resources, it all contributes to violence in the home.
So, Katie, I want to give those resources out, whether you are a parent who is struggling or you feel you can't handle it. If you are a young person who I doubt is listening to talk radio, it's more of the adults. So really, I want to give the resources out if you're somebody who's struggling or if you're someone who suspects a child is being abused in some way. What do they do? Who do they call?
So a report of suspected or confirmed abuse should be called into the Connecticut Department of Children and Families care line.
Okay. I can look up that number. What is the number for the Center for Family Justice if anybody wants to contact your offices?
Our number is 203-334-6154. And then we also have two hotlines. We have a sexual assault hotline, which is 203-333-2233, and the domestic violence hotline, which is 203-384-9559. And both hotlines are answered 24 hours a day.
All right. Well, Katie, we really appreciate you coming on the show this morning, and I thank you so much for the work that you do.
I appreciate you. Thank you so much.
All right. Over the weekend, we had three separate incidents where boats capsized in Connecticut waters. Unfortunately, we lost three people in two of those incidents, and we wanted to talk about boating safety, especially before we even get into Memorial Day weekend and the summer season. So joining me this morning from the Bridgeport Police Department Marine Unit is Officer Gilberto Davali. Officer Davali, thank you so much for coming on. How are you?
Good, and yourself?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much for asking. First of all, is this common? Do we see once the spring season happens, people are just itching to get their boats out on the water?
Yes, it is. A lot of people try to get their boats out on the water before they check them, do the safety checks before they go out to the sea. Yes.
Most of the, if not all of them, the boat capsizing incidents, for the most part, they're all still under investigation. But I do know, especially on Easter Sunday, two of those incidents that happened, wind seemed to be a big factor in why they capsized. Is that very common, that we see kind of windy conditions in the spring and something to really look at when you, especially if you have a smaller boat?
Yes, it is. Most people don't look at the weather conditions for the day, and especially when they're out in the sound, it has a change. So just have to be careful with the weather conditions out there.
What about the waters? And I don't mean the temperature yet. We'll dive into that in a second. But, are the waves rockier during the springtime? Are they about the same during the summer? What can you tell us about water conditions?
Well, the water conditions can change. Depends on the wind. If they're coming from the west, the waters are the best. If they're coming from the east, they're mostly like a beast.
Oh.
So that's the saying on the water.
I did not know that. Well, now I learned something new. Officer Davali is here this morning, and we're talking about water safety, boating safety, really. When do you think is a good time for boaters to take their crafts out on the water?
Well, they could take them out at most times, depending on the size of the vessel and if they're prepared for anything on the water, especially when they need to wear their life jackets, have enough life jackets for everyone that's on board of the boat.
But do you feel that they should wait until it gets a little warmer, or do you think as long as they're prepared and they are even avid boaters, that they could go out now is okay?
I mean, they can go out now. It's just a point of them being prepared for any changes in the climate, the weather, the wind, make sure that the boat is ready to be on the water. Just they have to make sure that they take the proper steps to get to being on the water.
Mm-hmm. And Officer Davali, I'm curious about water temperatures right now. My understanding in Stamford was the two men who did pass away, unfortunately, and the other two who were, I believe, are in critical condition. They're still in the hospital this morning. They were in the water for 30 to 40 minutes before they were rescued. What's the average temperature right now in the waters, and what does that do to the body when you're sitting in water like that for a half an hour?
About the average water temperature currently, it's about 10 degrees cooler than the outside temperature. The body can stay in the water depending on the equipment they have on, which is a personal flotation device or foul weather gear. They can remain in the water for approximately 15 to 20 minutes before hypothermia kicks in. After that, it's just trying to get out of the water and get dry as fast as possible.
So if hypothermia kicks in, what sort of is going on with your body and how long until it essentially shuts down? Like in this situation, unfortunately, it claimed two lives and it could potentially, we're praying it doesn't, but it could claim more lives in just this one situation.
Yes, it's 15 to 20 minutes. The body starts shutting down, the extremities, the heart, and that's it. Everything else just stops the function. The body will completely shut down, and then the person will drown. But they'll suffer from hypothermia as they're drowning.
Wow. Also, just using the Stamford example for this segment, we're talking to Officer Davali this morning out of Bridgeport's Marine Unit. It sounded like communication was also why the rescue didn't happen as quickly as it could have. Not to the fault of the rescuers, but it sounded like there was a language barrier. There was a hard time just pinpointing where this boat was. And eventually, it sounded like officers were able to get connected to the cell phone that was on that boat. What would you say to boaters who are going out to avoid having sort of the same thing happen? Are there tips that you would ask them to have ready in case there is a rescue needed to make sure we could cut down on a delay for people to get out there and get you out of the water?
Yes, they should have their coordinates of where they're at, location of where they're going. Make sure that they have a phone that works properly, or they can even go and out and purchase UHF marine radios, handheld units that can keep charged on the boat. Use them for emergencies, flares, mirror signaling devices. They have whistles that they can use on the water. They have a lot of equipment that they can pick up at their local marine supply places.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything else you want people to know before we really get into the thick of boating season?
Yes, please check your boats. Make sure that you have all the proper equipment. Make sure that you pay attention to your boats. Make sure that you pay attention to everyone that's on board, and you can account with the equipment, the life-saving equipment, life vests, life jackets, flotation devices for everyone on your boat. This way you can have a safe boating season.
Officer Gilberto Davali with Bridgeport's Marine Unit, we thank you so much for giving us the time this morning. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
Let's get wild. It's the Zoo Minute with Greg Dancho from Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo on Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Before we dive into where all this money is going, I do want to talk to Greg Dancho about how extraordinary this gift is. Because Greg Dancho, you and I know very well that the state doesn't just kind of show up all the time and go, here's a few million bucks here. Here's a few hundred thousand dollars here. This, to me, I don't know. Was this unexpected, the $4.1 million coming from the state of Connecticut? First of all, good morning. I'm so rude. Hello. How are
good
you?
Good morning.
I'm just very
good morning,
excited.
How
I'm doing fine.
I am, too. What a great birthday gift for our 100th anniversary.
Right?
It's a really, 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 it's a game changer for us in a lot of respects. We did request this. Senator Moore had put this on her bond request to the state of Connecticut. And we know that, you know, making requests are wonderful, but it really is if the request is activated. And the governor did put it on the bond agenda and then was voted on and was accepted. So we did get $4.1 million to Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo. And again, like I said, it's a game changer in that this is the largest single amount of money we've received from the state or from anybody for the zoo. And it adds to what we've been doing here. And so that's what makes it so exciting. It's with the, especially for the thing that's really near and dear to my heart, is the tigers, the tiger habitat. Mm-hmm. Like I think I mentioned on the show before, I started out in the zoo many, many years ago. One of the first major jobs working here at the zoo was working with the large cats and with the tigers, and was able to see Kimby be born here. Kimby, our first tiger ever born at the zoo. And so, again, the tigers, to me, are again, always have a special place for me. So when we were looking for funding, we for the tiger habitat, Pam Worth was so very generous a few years ago to give us $1 million toward that project. But however, that really wasn't going to cover the whole cost. So we started searching where could we get some more funding for this project. And again, here comes some funding from the state of Connecticut, not some funding, so major funding from the state of Connecticut. So that $4.1 million, we're going to take some of that. And we're going to add that to the money that we have already in place that we've raised from also from benefactors, from people out there that have given money for our tigers that we've been holding to get started on this project. And now that we have all the funding, well, we were going to start the project anyway. The tiger habitat was going to start this fall with the phase one of the project, which again was going to be an addition to the old yard. Which is going to more than double its size, new viewing window like we're doing the bears, like we do with the leopards, so we can have nice clear views of our most magnificent animals here at the zoo, a new pool, artificial rock work. So all that was going to start this fall. But phase two, which entails a new holding building for tigers, for babies and for tigers here at the zoo, two new yards that would increase the habitat, you know, quadruple the size we have right now. Adding a building that you can go inside, a la the wolf cabin.
I was going to say, like the wolf cabin.
Exactly. Go inside and through glass, be able to see the cats in the wintertime and in a climate-controlled environment and get a lot of educational potential in there. An above-ground walkway that the cats can use to get to that third yard, that third exhibit yard or habitat yard, which you'll be able to see the tigers walking above your head going to the third yard. And so this is really a dream come true for me and a dream come true for the zoo, I believe, and for our tigers. And we're really so excited about that. A lot of people ask, well, when is this going to start? Well, I've contacted the zoo architect that we've already had working on phase one and told them to start thinking about sitting down with us to now actuate the phase two project. It's been
so
started,
exciting.
But COVID kind of slowed it up a little bit. And so now we're going to go full steam and getting the design plans together so we can go out to bid as soon as we possibly can to get that tiger habitat completely redone. That's not all the money.
Because I wanted to. Here's the thing: there's a lot of exciting stuff. I know you're excited like I am. I mean, you and I, we could just go on. So, but I wanted to just reiterate really quickly how often, because I think sometimes when people hear $4 million, wow, it's a lot of money going to the zoo. Now, hold on one second. How often would you say, in all the years that you've worked at the zoo does not rely on state and local funding? Nothing is ever really, it's not like, oh, every year the state gives money, every year, it's kind of, if we get it, great, but it's very unexpected. You guys mostly rely on like ticket sales or if people donate, correct?
Right. We work basically on a nonprofit model where the majority of our funding is through on-ground sales, which is the ticket sales, the food stand, the gift shop, the carousel. I mean, there's so many buckets that we can talk about. And then another part of it is fundraising. So we're like our Wild Wine Safari that's going to be coming up on June 4th. the appeals that go out to people that support the zoo, that funding all comes back to the zoo. So a major majority of the funding for the facility is earned by us working hard to get that money into the zoo. So again, goes back to the animals. We do ask for funding from the state. We do ask, you know, funding. We get some funding from the city of Bridgeport also, which supports us through the sale that happened to us when we went private over 20 years ago. But yeah, it's the last time we received money. We received it for the bear exhibit, the bear habitat that we're finishing up now, and that was over 8 years ago. So
wow.
Yeah, this is something we don't really feel that again. We're not going to go out to agencies like the state or the city or the federal government without trying to do the best work we can here to raise our money here. So we want this to be a partnership. We want this to be that yes, we are going to do our due diligence to raise funding for ourselves. For the zoo and for the animals, and then hopefully we'll get help when we do that. And then this was a tremendous, tremendous help for us.
Yeah.
So yes, it's not all the time. Do we wish it? Do we wish to be part of, you know, a budget? Yeah, sure we do. That would be great, but that doesn't really work that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, after 100 years, again, like I said, after 100 years, this is the largest amount of money we've ever received in one fell swoop.
Mm-hmm.
So we're
wow.
really, really excited about it.
So again, it
and
is
for the Tigers again.
Yeah, of course. And again, it's $4.1 million. So as Greg had kind of hinted, the Tigers certainly are benefiting, but the money is going to go to other facets at the zoo. Greg Danchu and I are just ready to party over this incredible gift that came to the Beardsley Zoo earlier this week from the state of Connecticut. $4.1 million. We know a good chunk of that going to the tiger habitat on property. Where else is the money going, Greg?
Yeah, this is bonding money, and we're so excited about getting it. But yeah, we had other projects here at the zoo, and so really on our list that we always have. We always keep growing. It keeps growing and keeps moving and keeps changing. But the other thing was our greenhouse. Our greenhouse was built in 1960s. The new section, the old section, or the center section, was actually predates the zoo. It's older than the zoo. So that whole situation with the greenhouse is that we want to be able to build for endangered plants also. Now, we know we work with endangered species of animals, but also we work with endangered species of plants. And so to do a remake of the north side of the greenhouse is again in the best interest of the plants that we have there, but also it's also resources. That's an old section that does not have the glass or the setup that would be good for the environment. You know, it uses too much energy.
Okay.
You know, a greenhouse, you would think, if you want to think about a greenhouse should be exactly what you want. You want
right.
something that doesn't use a lot of energy. But when it's made of the old glass, it doesn't have the insulation properties. So it does use a lot of oil and gas, but gas in the wintertime to keep it warm. So with this, we'll do a total redo of that north side of the greenhouse. And also it will give us a chance to add more to people who want to come into the zoo. Years ago, we were known as Beardsley Zoological Gardens. And what we want to do is we want to get the gardens our greenhouseman is doing a great job, to get all of our plants and all of our on grounds and inside the greenhouse plants really thriving. We got a great orchid display in there. We have the koi in there that people can see with the fish in there. We have a bunch of aloes and cacti in there. So again, a lot of people don't go in the greenhouse because they come to the zoo,
mm-hmm.
but there are people that want to come to see plants. So we also want to make sure that we do the right thing in the greenhouse. So that funding will also go there to redo that the project. And then the third thing is our condor. Condor, Teresita, she's over 60 years old. She is in the oldest exhibit here at the zoo, and we really want to see that redone to make a large flight aviary for our condors. And so that would be the third project on the list.
We may have to
strain a little bit because $4.1 million sounds like a lot of money, but boy, it does get eaten up really quickly.
Sure, yeah.
So we're gonna do the best thing we can to make sure we maximize the this tremendous gift we got from the state of Connecticut.
So the tigers are going to start in the fall. And then when do you think the greenhouse, when do you think the condor?
Greenhouse will probably sometime next year. And
okay.
then condor will be working on design because we have to get a design in place. That's kind of the project that is the least put together at this point.
Okay.
So we really want to do the right thing to make sure we have the right section of the zoo to put it in. The larger area that we can put it in, and again, just do a great job for the Condor. We were so happy that the governor came and did an announcement here and came and visited the zoo again, walked around, especially when the kids are off school this week. I was able to see a lot of kids and families here. And I think what we're seeing in Connecticut is hopefully a resurgence in the attractions that we have, and I don't like saying attractions sometimes, but the cultural areas.
I know what
that
you mean,
have.
Though. Yeah.
And the zoo is a cultural experience. The museums, all of the things that we have in Connecticut that we've kind of let go to the side a little bit, and that's really what makes Connecticut all these wonderful places you can go to visit with your kids and learn things here in Connecticut. So we're kind of hoping that this whole thing with the free Connecticut last year, the attendance was free last year to a lot of our attractions, and now some funding coming in. We're hoping that Connecticut is really starting to see that this is very important for the for how we're going to live in our state.
Oh, absolutely. And learning about conservation, not to mention it, to yep. me, in my mm-hmm. opinion, it was yep. the best place yep. where we had our field trips. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, I guarantee there are hundreds yep. of students who will sit there and go, yeah, I agree with that morning girl. It was the best place to have our field trips. So I think it's a very exciting gift, and congratulations to the Beer Zoo.
Really excited. Yeah. Thank you so much. And again, we thank everybody that's helped support this. So again, it's looking to be a good 100th year.
Oh, it is, right? Talk about a big birthday gift for 100. Very, very exciting, Greg Dancho. Thank you so much.
All right. You guys take care. Have a great week, Melissa, and we'll see you soon, hopefully.
I look forward to it. Oh, yeah. We'll be there very soon.